supporters of limited government, either libertarians or conservatives, have a problem. And the problem is that the main reason that most of them want to limit government is they believe that governments are bad at doing things, especially difficult things. That if the government is in charge of agriculture, we might starve to death. If the government is in charge of building cars, they are likely to break down rapidly and be very expensive. The problem is that if government is bad at doing things, creating a legal system is not a trivial problem. It may even be harder to design a legal system than to design a car. So if governments are bad at designing cars, why do we want them to design the legal system? If they're bad at doing other things, why do we want them to do anything? There's an answer to that. The answer to that is the claim that the narrow set of things that these people want government to do are things that government does badly, but that the alternatives to government do even worse. That a badly run legal system is arguably better than no legal system at all. And there isn't a whole lot of point to abolishing your government if some foreign country then invades you and imposes their government on you. That's the basic argument, I think, in favor of the traditional sort of classical liberal limited government position. It's not an absurd argument. Interesting arguments rarely are. I believe that two of the three, the traditional minimal functions are court, police, and national defense. Some people would expand it, but I'm going to limit myself to those three. Courts and police, I do not think are a particularly hard problem. I realize many other people do. That's not what this talk is about. However, my first book, The Machinery of Freedom, is available as a free PDF on my webpage in the current second edition. Part three of that book sketched how you might have a functioning society in which law and law enforcement were entirely private. And if people want to discuss that after this, we can. But what I want to talk about is what I referred to in that book as the hard problem, which is national defense. Where by national defense, I mean not defense of a nation, but defense against nations. Because you can always argue that if we abolish our government, we're not a nation anymore. And the basic problem with national defense is that it's what economists call a public good. A public good does not mean a good produced by government. A public good means a good such that if you produce it at all, it will be available to all of the members of a pre-existing group of people, so that the producer cannot control who gets it. And the obvious problem with public goods is that for an ordinary private good, the way I get the revenue to pay the cost of producing the good is I say to the people who want it, if you don't pay me, you don't get it. That's how we produce cars and groceries and such. But I can't do that if I produce it, I can't control who gets it. The fact that something is a public good does not mean that it can't be produced privately. That, in fact, quite a lot of public goods are. My favorite example would be radio broadcasts. A radio broadcast is quite a pure public good. And the solution to that, come up by some unnamed genius, was to produce not one public good, but two. You produce one public good which has a private positive value to the consumer and a positive cost of production. That's called a radio program. And you produce one public good that has a negative value to the consumer and a negative cost of production, and you call that an advertisement. And you tie the two tightly together and give away the package. And since people will pay you to put on ads, that's how you pay your bills. That's one example, and I can give many others if I discuss other examples in machinery, of imperfect ways of producing public goods. So that the basic implication of the public good argument is not that if something is a public good, it can't be produced privately, but only that we have much weaker reasons to think it can be produced privately than if it were a private good. And in particular, we have pretty good reasons to think that any private good that's worth producing will get produced. There are some exceptions to that, but take that as a good first approximation. We do not have any good reason to believe that any public good that's worth producing will get produced. In particular, if you had a public good that cost $1,000 to produce and was worth $1,100, it's quite likely it wouldn't get produced, that the imperfect ways we have of funding public goods probably can't do that good a job. So the question that I then want to discuss is whether or not there are plausible imperfect ways of producing the public good of national defense. And notice that the fact that we will do it imperfectly doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, because we don't expect governments to do things perfectly. So that if we start out with the assumption that governments are bad at doing things, the question is not, is the private arrangement good at doing it, but only is it less bad. And in thinking through ways we might solve the problem, what I think of as kludges, imperfect ways, I've actually put together ideas from a rather strange collection of sources, which include the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution, a little-known Rudyard Kipling short story, my hobby of fighting other people with swords and shields in the Society for Creative Anachronism, a somewhat more popular hobby called paintball, open-source software, and probably a couple of other things. And let me start with the Second Amendment. As I interpret, I assume everybody here is familiar with the Second Amendment. That's the one which is usually brought in the context of the right to bear arms. But it also has a mention of a militia, which does or doesn't qualify. It doesn't matter for my purposes. In my view, the right way of making sense of the Second Amendment is that it was a solution to a problem that 18th century scholars were seriously worried about. And the problem was that, as Oliver Cromwell had demonstrated in the previous century, a professional army beats an amateur army. And Oliver Cromwell had also demonstrated the problem with having a professional army, because after Oliver Cromwell and the New Model Army won the first English Civil War for Parliament, they then won the second Civil War for themselves, and Oliver Cromwell spent the rest of his life as military dictator of England. Lord Protector, I think, was his official title, as I remember. Pretty good ruler, I think, as English rulers go. But you can see that it's a little bit disturbing if you say, well, if we don't have a professional army, we're going to lose all our wars, and if we do, the professional army will take over. And the solution, as I understand it, my interpretation, I can't prove this is what was in people's heads, of the Second Amendment, is that the idea was to combine a small professional army with an enormous amateur militia. So the militia is essentially all adult males. The professional army is a much smaller group of people. In peacetime, the professional army has the job of coordinating the militia, of providing training and doing various things such that if there is a war, the militia units from the different states can work with each other and with the professionals. And then if there is a war, the professionals are, in a sense, the leadership part of it, but most of the mass of the army is made up of the militia, and the hope is that having enormous numbers is going to make up for the low quality of the militia. And at the same time, you've solved Cromwell's problem, because if the professionals try to take over, they're outnumbered something more than 100-1, and they're not going to succeed. And insofar as you can judge on historical evidence, it worked. The U.S. was never conquered, and the U.S. never had a successful, even unsuccessful military coup. So that set of problems is a problem, set of problems which exist for a stateless society as well. If we imagine that we have an anarchist society, suppose we had a perfectly reliable way of raising the money to fund a full-scale military, which we don't, let's get to later. So as we did, we'd still have to worry that that military would then be a potential reestablisher of a government in their own interest. Right? So from that standpoint, something that looks rather like the Second Amendment scheme looks like an attractive idea to try to look at for us. Right? My second source is a Rudyard Kipling story called The Army of a Dream. Rudyard Kipling, I should say, was not a libertarian. He was a very interesting guy, and he wrote one anarchist poem I'm rather fond of. After the talk is over, if people are curious, I can probably reproduce it for you. And some other poems that say things libertarians would like. But this particular story is called The Army of a Dream. And the narrator, who is presumably Kipling, has returned to England after a long time and is having it explained to him how things have changed by a friend of his who's a military officer. And the basic change is that the main sport of England is no longer either football or cricket. It's military games. It's war games, done at a scale of an inch to an inch. The kind of war games where you've got a bunch of people running around a field or a forest or something, and some set of rules to figure out if this was for real, who would have won. And in the story, as he tells it, this is what, you know, the public school kids do and older people do and so forth. And he's describing a system in which being an amateur soldier is sort of woven into the fabric of the society. It's not an anarchist society. It's clear that some of this is being supported in various ways by the regular military and by various legal rules, but that the main support for it is really a sort of a social pressure custom kind of support. And the result is that England is in the situation Switzerland is in, except they're doing it not with mandatory military service, but with a system which anybody worth anything has in fact volunteered in one context or another to get trained as a soldier, maybe done, I think they're doing a six-month tour of duty or something, and then is not really a soldier anymore. And I thought that was very intriguing in terms of imagining a different mechanism by which you could get an army. I should say at the end of the story, the narrator remembers that the person he's just been talking with died some years earlier, and he then remembers that the person, the friend who's been showing him around, was with him when they received the body of the other soldier, and died a few years later. And at that point, his guide turns, and the side of him that he's been keeping away from the narrator is the side with the lethal wound in it, and the narrator wakes up and realizes this was all the army of a dream. It's quite a neat story. It's on the web, actually, if you want to read it. But in any case, again, it sort of intrigued me in terms of thinking about ways in which social mechanisms could be used to help produce an army. Then my third one is a number of institutions that exist in the real world at present. That the Society for Creative Anachronism, which I've been involved with it for over 40 years now, I guess, is a organization of people who do medieval and Renaissance stuff for fun. Every summer they have a two-week event in a private campground about an hour north of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at which you will have battles with perhaps 1,000 people aside. Now, it's true that the weapons used there would not be very useful in modern warfare, since they're largely swords and shields and spears. And they wouldn't even be very useful in medieval warfare, because the way in which you do fighting as a sport is to have real armor and fake weapons. So that you're really fighting, you're doing the best you can, but the swords are made of rattan, they're not sharp-edged, they're about the right weight for a real sword, and the armor is mostly made of steel. On the other hand, if you think about it in terms of the investment those people are making in their equipment and their training, it is an investment that would be easily suited to give you a moderately competent amateur soldier. That the same amount they're spending on their armor and swords and stuff could be spent on an assault rifle and, you know, the other appropriate things. And you could get a lot of the same fun out of it if you organized it in some game form. You're firing blanks or you're doing something else to make it the same kind of a sport. And one in which you've got people who are doing it for fun. That if you replace professionals by amateurs, and the amateurs cost half as much, it doesn't save you any money if you need twice as many of them. But if they cost nothing at all, it does. All right? So I'm looking for ways in which you can get your manpower essentially for free. Now, the SCA is not a very large organization, but I looked up the numbers on paintball. And the estimate is, for a few years back, figures I found, that there were 2 million people who played paintball at least 15 times in the course of a year, and that the total expenditures on paintball equipment were about $400 million. All right, that's getting towards the scale that would fund a real army. All right, so that suggests that you might be able to set up a system in which most of your manpower consisted of people who had trained for warfare, had done it for fun, were encouraged to do so by the fact that it was not only fun but patriotic, that not only were they proving that they were really good at winning fake wars, but they could say to everything, you know, if the Mexicans ever invade us, I'm the one who will save you. Or the Canadians. I'll come back to that point later, but the basic point being that a lot of your resources you would get that way. Now, the weapons for a single soldier are well within the resources of most Americans. Tanks and fighter planes and such are more expensive. On the other hand, in the kind of society I'm imagining, there would be reasons for firms to want to demonstrate what good, patriotic, public-spirited people they were, so people would buy their product. So that I like to imagine that in the Liberty Day parade we have every April 15th, there is a squad of soldiers flying Apple's banner, who are Apple employees, who Apple has slightly subsidized, giving them time off for military exercises and such. And they're being led by a robot tank built by Apple, or at least paid for by Apple. No doubt Microsoft will have a larger squad and perhaps a bunch of drones over them. I don't know what the technology will be, but the basic point is that one way in which you can get significant amounts of money available is for the PR advantages of firms, just as what firms nowadays spend money on various things seen as publicly good projects. So I think that gives you a plausible way of getting most of your resources. It doesn't give you a professional army. So I am assuming that in addition to what I'm describing, you will have a cadre. You will have a body of professional soldiers paid for by charity, paid for by voluntary donations, but they don't have to be a very large body. They are going to be in the thousands, not in the millions. And their function in peacetime is to give or perhaps sell services to the amateurs. You can imagine they're functioning as referees. They're helping to make sure that the amateurs have weapons whose parts are interchangeable or use the same ammunition or the same communication codes. I don't know what the technology will be in the future. But you would have a relatively small cadre of professionals, a large body of amateurs, and that would give you a sort of an anarchist equivalent of the model that the Second Amendment was designed to set up. That's sort of the basic plan that I'm describing. I think I have enough time to tell you my short story idea. Which is suggests there's something I said. And this is it's a conversation in this future society between two people who are trying to understand why the nuclear attack that a revived Russia launched against the U.S. didn't work. Why, in fact, all of the missiles blew up on launch. And one of them says, well, you know, I'm not sure. But do you remember the marksmanship contests last year where the people from Apple won, even though they couldn't hit the broadside of a barn because they hacked into the scoring computers? I think they did it again. So anybody who wants to write that story can. I should say one of the many things on my webpage is a list of story ideas that I'm not going to write. Things that I think would make neat stories, but they don't really grab me as stories, they grab me as ideas. And they're up for free. It's one of the more popular parts of my webpage, and I've had several people who have written stories to them, and when they're good stories, I've webbed them, linked with their permission, of course, linked to it. The neat ones are the ones who see a way of following out the story that hadn't occurred to me. And there have been, I think, at least one, but maybe two of those who did that, and that was lots of fun. Anyway, let me go on to point at another example of the sort of thing I'm describing, which is not close to defense, but is a nice demonstration that you can do quite sophisticated things other than by direct either government or market mechanisms. All right, we've got the two mechanisms we tend to think in terms of are either government collects taxes and spends the money on a military, or private firms produce things to sell. Those are both possible ways of doing things. Lots of things are done those ways. But I'm trying to look at ways of doing things that don't really fit that pattern, and there are a fair number. Let me go back just for a moment to raising money for our cadre, for our professionals. Think about tipping. This is an example I actually used in my first book. When you tip a waiter, you may get something in return if you're a regular patron of that restaurant, but a lot of us aren't. And a lot of us tip even when we're traveling and are in a restaurant we'll never be in again. Total revenue in the U.S. from tips, as far as I can tell, is about $40 billion a year. So that, in a sense, is money, a large part of which is being given for reasons of social pressure, of feeling what a good person ought to do, not because you're getting something for it. Taxi cabs, the tipping is almost entirely that, because you're very unlikely to get the same taxi cab. Again, there my rough estimate is about $1 billion a year, though I don't have very good numbers on that. So I think that's some evidence of what one might think of as, in some sense, non-market ways of raising money, which exists. There are lots of other examples, but those are ones where you're getting the kinds of money. In fact, more. I think the $40 billion is probably a lot more than we need for my cadre. I suspect a few billion a year will probably fund them. And you will notice that part of what we're getting out of what I'm describing is a solution to the Second Amendment problem. The same solution as the Second Amendment solution. Because in the system I'm describing, the cadre are enormously outnumbered. The cadre are not going to be able to do a military coup by themselves. They'll get shot down by the amateurs. And the amateurs are a very dispersed group. The amateurs aren't a single organization that could go in and do a coup. The people at Apple and people at Microsoft are never going to cooperate, not to mention the people at Google, not to mention the farmers' units and the this units and the that units, if you think of all of the different things that would plausibly exist in this sort of a society. So that basically it's a popular mass army, as it were. So in that sense, I think that works. Will it work? I don't know. I think whether it works depends on a number of different features of the imagined future society. A lot of it depends on cultural factors, that it depends on the kind of society whose members like it. That if you look at some of the historical examples, I believe it is a correct statement that Australia in World War I had no draft. And I think it is also a correct statement that the fraction of Australians who died in World War I, I think, is probably larger than the fraction of either Americans or British, though maybe not the British. But it was quite a, they for their very small population, they had a very large number of volunteers. So that would be one example. There are other examples. People who buy war bonds knowing they're a bad deal are in effect voluntarily subsidizing what they see as a good cause. People who donate firearms. At the beginning of World War II, one of the things the British did was basically get a lot of people to hand in their shotguns and things so they could arm their more or less militia units in case the Germans got across the channel, which fortunately they never did. So I think there's some evidence for that. Another source, I guess, not really for this solution, but for thinking about these things, which I would recommend, is a book by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle, two very good science fiction writers, not libertarians, although both of them have libertarian sympathies, called Oath of Fealty. And the central point of Oath of Fealty is that a private organization that serves the functions we associate with government will become the focus for the same sort of emotional loyalties that we now focus on governments. So that in the story, what's happened is, this is a not very distant future, I suppose it's 20 years from now maybe, and there has been at some point a riot in Los Angeles that burned out a part of the city. And an international corporation makes a deal with the city of Los Angeles that they will build an arcology, essentially a small city that's a single building on the wrecked area, on the deal that the city of Los Angeles then subcontracts the government functions to them. So they'll pay the city some fixed amount in lieu of taxes. They will provide law enforcement within it and so forth. And as the story goes, there is a, for some reason, environmentalists don't like the arcology. I don't think the authors adequately justify that, but it's not implausible. Environmentalists don't like fracking, even though it's the one thing that has actually reduced carbon dioxide production sizably. So the environmentalists don't like it. And there is a fake terrorist raid by some environmentalists. These are basically college-age kids carrying boxes designed to look like boxes full of dynamite. They've really got sand in them as sort of a demonstration stunt. And they've done a very good job of hacking through the computer defenses, which are defending a pipeline bringing hydrogen, which is the fuel source, into the arcology. And if it was really dynamite and they blew it up, they would kill, you know, tens of thousands of people, do enormous damage. The last-ditch defense against intruders is a lethal gas. The top official of the arcology is out of town. His deputy makes the decision, pushes the button, kills the attackers, one of whom turns out to be the daughter of a high-up Los Angeles City politician. He is arrested by the Los Angeles police. The top official comes back to the arcology, and the point of view, you're then seeing this largely in terms of his interaction with a newspaper reporter. And the reporter says to him, if you'll let me cover the story, I won't tell. What won't you tell? that you're planning to break him out of jail. How do you know we're planning to break him out of jail? Because all of your people expect you to. Because from their standpoint, he is not an unjustly accused person. He's a prisoner of war. He was defending them, the supporters of the attackers he was defending them against, and now got him as a prisoner, and therefore it's our job to break him out and get him somewhere far away, which is what happens, of course. And I thought, the point in the sense of that whole thing is the title, Oath of Fealty. The point, which I thought was a very interesting point, Niven, I'm not sure if he's still the best idea person in science fiction, but I think he was for quite a while. And Cornell is not as good an idea person, but a really good storyteller. And it seems that the central idea of that story really was the very interesting point that we've got a set of emotional attitudes we associate with loyalty and nationalism and a bunch of stuff like that. And if it's a private organization that's protecting us, we'll probably focus those on it as well. So that's sort of an interesting feature to think about. I should say that Niven also has a short story called Cloak of Anarchy, which is quite a good anti-anarchist story. Anarchists should always read anti-anarchist stories, make them think about what are the weaknesses in their position. So I would recommend that. So whether it works really depends partly on the cultural values, partly on to what extent people like their own society, partly on how serious the threats are. When I wrote Machinery and had a chapter on this subject called The Hard Problem, I was not all that optimistic, because at that time the threat was the Soviet Union, which was at least appeared to be a serious military power. Not clear if it really was, but at least it looked to be comparable to us in terms of our power. And so it looked as though you had to spend quite a lot of money in order to adequately defend against it. Currently, that's not the case. Soviet Union self-destructive. At the time of the first Iraq war, I did some arithmetic for my own curiosity. I added up the GNP of the two sides in that war. The odds were 100 to 1. That's not a war. All right. Canada is very unlikely to invade the U.S., even if the U.S. does something as terrible as to become anarchist. Mexico is very unlikely to invade us. Our current international problems are almost all the result of having an active and aggressive foreign policy, which, whether a good or bad thing, has the downside of making people mad at us. I could discuss, if people are curious, my view of the whole argument about interventionist versus non-interventionist foreign policy. I think people get the lesson of Munich exactly backwards, but that would be I'll talk about that if people want. I think we're going to have time. But in any case, I think that if you imagine a U.S. with essentially no foreign policy other than peace and honest friendship and trade with everybody, which is more or less George Washington's prescription, that then the only real danger would be countries that thought it was profitable to invade us. And I think it's very hard to believe that any of the wealthy, powerful, developed countries is likely to do that, say, in the next 50 years. It's hard to predict much beyond that. In addition to which, if I and many of us are right about the fact that markets work better than governments, once you've had an anarchist society for a few decades, you're likely to be quite a lot richer and more advanced than anybody else, and that's going to make it harder for them to invade you. I should mention actually one other in the mentioning stories. There's a story by Werner Vinge, who may be a current competitor for best idea person, called The Ungoverned. And that's a story in the future about the invasion of an anarcho-capitalist area by an adjacent state. And one of the assumptions is the state is poorer than the anarcho-capitalist area and more backwards. And that also is very interesting. It interested me in particular because it's interesting to see what my system looks like imagined by a writer rather than an economist. And one of the really interesting points is the way in which people on both sides of the conflict see everything in their own terms. So in Vinge's imagined anarchist society, there are people he refers to as armadillos. And an armadillo is somebody who is unhappy with the private legal system of the anarchist society and opts out, which means he has very little to do with other people, avoids possible conflict, and arms himself heavily for self-defense. And in the story, there is a wealthy farmer. I think his son lost a law case 20 years before or something. So he became an armadillo, and he's been putting all of his surplus income into turning his farm into a fortress. Adjacent state invades. Some enterprising teenagers launch a fake attack from the, I think using fireworks or something, from the direction of the farm. All right, invading army, heads in that direction, runs into a fortress. It never occurs to them that they can walk around it. From their standpoint, obviously this is part of the gangsters, which I think is the term they're using for the anarcho-capitalist system, of their defensive perimeter. We've got to destroy it. Given that he's put all his money into that, and given that it's a richer society, his fortress is strong enough so that destroying it, although doable, is not a trivial project. So it takes them a while. They take some losses. There is somebody from the local rights enforcement agency. He was a prisoner of the invaders at this point. At which point it turns out that he had one last-ditch defense, a nuclear weapon, and a very deep hole. And he and his family go into a very deep hole. They set off an A-bomb over their heads and take out about a third of the invading army. At which point the leader on the other side turns to the guy from the rights enforcement agency and says, "What kind of slime are you using nukes against us?" And the guy looks at him and says, "What do you mean us? He's not our customer." And I just thought it was a beautiful example of the way each side, as it were, sees everything in their language. I should say, I particularly like that story because at the end of it, Vinja credits my book, Machinery of Freedom, as the background for the society he's using. And he's also a friend of mine. He's an interesting guy. And a libertarian, I should say. But in any case, so those are some of the interesting sources. But I think I went into that much detail only because I think I'm a little under my time, not as usual over my time. I expect we'll have questions. And I guess the final comment I wanted to make is the same as the final comment that I made 40 years ago. And that is, if you conclude that you can't defend yourself privately, then it's too soon to abolish the last vestiges of government. That, as I put it then, I would prefer not to pay taxes to either Washington or Moscow, but Washington's rates are lower. Questions? Yes.
You did your book kind of, they're saying in your introduction, from the cost-benefit analysis or consequentialist or utilitarian.
Consequentialist is the best description,
okay.
I think.
So consequentialist, there are obviously a lot of natural rights types as well. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on the other side?
Sure.
How you think they relate to each other?
I understand. My basic view is not that moral arguments are wrong, but that they are inadequately convincing. That is, I have moral beliefs which suggest that lots of the things I'm against politically are also wicked things, but I don't have really good arguments for those moral beliefs. That as far as I can tell, David Hume was correct in the 18th century when he argued that you could not deduce an ought from an is, that therefore you could not show people who didn't share your moral intuitions that they ought to. This is what I found intriguing when I first read Ayn Rand, was that she really thought she had solved that problem. And I looked at enough of her work to convince myself that she hadn't, that she was fooling herself. If people are curious, you can find my webpage. It's got lots of stuff if you're curious, by the way. It's got the full text of about 5 of my books, I suppose, at this point, something like that, 4 of my books. And but one of the things you can find in the libertarian chunk of it is a sketch of sort of my response to Rand's arguments. Furthermore, I also concluded that you don't have to win the moral argument because the range of people's moral beliefs is not as large as people like to pretend. That it struck me a long time ago that when you're running through hypothetical arguments with a socialist, you don't even agree on the hypothetical, let alone the morals. So that in my hypothetical, the two men went into the forest, and one man worked hard, and he cleared land, and he planted crops, and the other guy just wandered through the forest picking berries. And then, when the second guy gets hungry, maybe because berries are no longer in season, and he demands of the rich, he's now the poor guy, and the one who did the work is the rich guy, he demands that the rich guy should share some of his wealth. Oh no, the socialist says, that's not what happened at all. You got it exactly backwards. The poor guy was the one who did all the work of clearing the forest, then the rich guy stole it from him. And it seems to me that what's going on in the fact that we don't want to agree on hypotheticals is that if we did, it would be harder to disagree about our conclusions. That essentially, each one, we have a sufficiently similar underlying moral beliefs, I think. Most people do, I think. So that if we really agreed on the facts, we would usually agree on the conclusion. That it is always tempting, since most of us overestimate how good our reasons are for our beliefs, it's tempting to say, well, you must agree with me about the facts. So the only reason that you're opposed to raising the minimum wage is that you want corporations to make lots of money and poor people to starve. And I've tried sort of to see if I could point out what's going on to people who make that kind of argument, saying, well, look, you know, perfectly obvious that raising the minimum wage law will throw poor unskilled workers out of work. You must be a really wicked person to want to throw all those people out of work. And of course, what's really going on, I think, is that you have disagreements about the consequences of institutions, and that those get, as it were, imagined as fundamental disagreements on morality. So I don't think I have met any socialists who would prefer what I think a socialist society would be like to what I think a free market society would be like. And I'm not even sure that I would prefer what some of the socialists think a free market society would be like to what they think a socialist society would be like. I mean, Orwell is probably the best example, because Orwell was somebody who saw the potential downside of socialism, thought maybe you could get away with it, but fundamentally, he badly underestimated how well the market system worked. There's a wonderful book review by Orwell, jointly reviewing The Road to Serfdom by Hayek, and a book by a very left-wing British member of parliament called Ziliakis, Connie Ziliakis. And what Orwell says is that Professor Hayek argues that socialism must lead to mass murder, censorship, a slave society, and the only alternative is laissez-faire capitalism. Mr. Ziliakis argues very persuasively that free market capitalism must lead to massive inequalities, monopoly, mass unemployment, and the only alternative is socialism. It is a sobering thought that they may both be right. That's why I like Orwell, that he's willing to think that kind of thought, to consider there might not be a solution. You've got to consider both. So in any case, I guess my basic point is that my conclusion a long time ago is that I have good arguments for my economic views. I have much weaker arguments for my moral views. And there is enough moral agreement among most, if not all, people so that if I can convince them of my economic views, almost everybody will agree with my conclusions. That's my argument for consequentialism. So it's not that I claim that morals aren't true or don't matter. And I am not a utilitarian, because I can easily enough imagine a case where total utility was increased and I disapproved of it anyway. But I'm not even a consequentialist, because I'm not willing to claim the only thing that ever matters is consequences. What I'm going to claim is that the sensible basis to argue for my positions is consequences. All right. Yes. That is, the Somalia case, we actually know quite a lot about what the traditional legal system was of northern Somalia. The owners of Walmart have totally but all this money compared to what? You're talking about individuals whose total wealth might be as much as one day's expenditure of the federal government. That's roughly the scale. I don't know. You can work out what's the current federal budget? Everybody remembers several trillion. If it's 3-point-something trillion, that means that it's about $10 billion a day. All right. There might be, I'm not sure if the Koch brothers might be worth more than $10 billion, I'm not sure. Gates, I think, is worth more than $10 billion, but almost none of the rich people are worth more than about one day's expenditure to the federal government. So and that's wealth, not income, right? Their actual, in effect, control is more like 1/5,000th or 1/10,000th of the federal government.
So how would that prevent from, warlords from trying to take power over other peoples?
The point is, that is, you're really getting into the stuff of the first two functions, the police and court kind of functions. But what I would argue is that individuals wish to be protected from having their rights violated. They will therefore be willing to pay private firms to sell that service.
the total resources representing the desire of ordinary people to not have be trampled on are very much larger than the resources that any of the people you're imagining have available. If you look at the market at present, you don't observe that most of GM's activity goes to making gold-plated Cadillacs for millionaires, or even that Tesla is a large part of the market. What you observe, I think, in most parts of the market is that most production is aimed at sort of the middle three-quarters or so of the population, which is where most of the expenditure is. So I don't think that that's very likely. But if you ask the more general question of under what circumstances our system is stable or unstable, that would be a different talk. If you're curious enough, I've given lots of talks that people have videoed and you can find on YouTube. And I do have a discussion in what I think is probably called the Market for Law, or maybe towards the third edition of Machinery of Freedom. And I discuss the circumstances in which my system would be unstable. But the instability I'm worrying about is not your story, but it's rather a case in which the number of private firms selling rights protection is small enough so that they can get together, form a cartel, and reestablish government. And that's what I see, at least, as the potential instability, and that's going to depend on sort of economy of scale kinds of arguments in that system. If you're curious about that. Yeah.
One thing I was like, for an anarcho-capitalist system, if most people are arguing not ready for that kind of system,
I'm a very conservative anarchist. Unlike Murray Rothbard, if there was a button that would abolish state, I wouldn't push it. I think that it takes time and effort to develop institutions. So what I am in favor of doing is gradually reducing government activities. There are a few of them that I'd be happy to abolish tomorrow, such as the war on drugs and all tariffs. But there are others which I think you could reasonably hope to abolish over a decade or so. And while doing that, one tries to build up alternatives. I think that abolishing the post office would be less obviously crazy now than it would have been 30 years ago because FedEx and UPS are now doing something very much like the post office. Everybody knows that they use it routinely and so forth. So I think it's pretty obvious. Plus email, of course, which is one reason the post office is going broke. So I think that in general, part of what you have to do is to establish the alternative institutions and at the same time cut back on government. Similarly, I am in favor of a voucher program for education. I think in the long run, obviously, if you have no government, you have no vouchers, but a voucher program would get you to a world where the production was private, even though the spending on it was being subsidized by the state. And that makes shifting to a fully private system become less frightening. Most people will see that what they're paying in taxes is comparable to what they're getting in subsidy. And you'll probably be able to figure out that there's some small fraction of the population who are really poor and that you can raise enough charitable money to make sure their kids can go to school too if they want to. Yes.
So I certainly appreciate that you are demolishing the myth that defense is impossible in an anarchist society, but I'm also concerned that with your idea of militias, it would require a kind of widespread inculcation of militaristic values among the populace. So I would want to know how would like hippie pacifists like myself be able to rely on the division of labor that kind of defense that I would.
We don't require the whole population to be in the militia, is the basic answer. So in the system I'm imagining, people who weren't militaristic but were patriotic might contribute money, they might contribute in other ways, they might do intelligence research on what's going on abroad and feed the information to the cadre or whoever was looking for it. People who were really pacifist would do nothing at all, and some of their friends would make fun of them as being free riders, and they would say, ah, no, you're just killers. I mean, that's what happens today, after all. But I don't think you require a uniform culture. And it's interesting how you define militarism, because I guess it's not clear to me that liking to play at war has much correlation with actually wanting to kill people or actually being militaristic. That my impression, for example, my first novel was published by Bain Publishing, which is an interesting firm in very many ways, but they really specialize largely in military SF. And I would say the tone of their stuff tends to be, on the whole, moderately libertarian. Not all of it, by any means. But, I mean, even their Trotskyite author is really a pretty libertarian Trotskyite. Some of you will know who I'm thinking of. Yeah.
So I understand the concept of, you know, keeping a core group of people that are professionals, and in my imagination, I imagine that those people would be generals or officers of some sort or good organizing, because that seems like the most logical choice. And then I understand that the culture is going to support war games, so a lot of people are going to be quick to organize. But I feel like an invading nation, a very common strategy, is that they're going to understand that to organize a defense means that it takes time. So to get those generals in contact with those people means that our defenses will, quote-unquote, be down until those generals can take over and organize the militia in a way that can appropriately defend. So there's going to be heavy casualties until that army organizes. Is that what I'm understanding?
I don't think so. I think, because I would assume that in peacetime, the cadre is interacting with the militia, that the cadre are the referees in the war games. The cadres are the people who teach classes on the newest rifle that's come out and why you should or shouldn't use it. And they probably write articles for, you know, fan magazines kinds of things. So I don't see that would be any more of a problem. There's a certain sense, of course, in which any war starting has the effect you're saying, because nobody knows what it's going to be like until it happens.
Yep.
So actually one thing, when I hear you kind of talking about the society, kind of how it would be built, when you were thinking about this, how much similarity does that look to, say, something like Rome and its own structure, right? Largely built on military conquest, right? Honor, in terms of...
But Rome had a professional military, a very good professional military. They didn't depend on citizen volunteers, unless you're thinking about... I don't know how early you're thinking about, but yeah, that is... Roman Empire, those are all professional soldiers. So that's not really the kind of system I'm describing at all, I don't think.
So can you think about something in the sense of...
Now, very early Rome, you've got something closer to a citizen army.
Pretty much, right? Yeah. Your welfare would be then... But the people that were...
Well, the wealth.
Make up the cavalry, right?
Those were the equites, but the legion was the main part, and that was ordinary people. And similarly for the Athenian system. I think I missed you before when it's unclear which direction I was pointing.
You have one example with these cultural games that people might play.
Right.
And that's in opposition to either a government solution or a market solution.
Right.
You have further examples that are different than government and market.
Well, I guess there's a sense in which the open source movement is different. The open source software, how many people here are already familiar with open source software? Probably most or many of you. It's clearly impossible. That is to say, it produces very sophisticated, difficult things, such as an operating system and the software that most web servers run on and so forth. And it does it not by hiring people to do it, but by using volunteers. And the volunteers are motivated by a mix of incentives, one of which is status. Status, especially with the people they want status from, or with the people who do the kind of stuff they do, so that they want other programmers to know, I'm the guy who made that really neat feature there. There's also a kind of what I think of as a gift economy. That is to say, if I did one part of Linux, the people who are experts on other parts of Linux know who I am and sort of feel grateful to me. So when I need something I can't do and I say, look, can anybody produce a printer driver for this new printer I've got? There's someone in the Linux community who's the printer driver enthusiast. Yeah, I'll gladly do you a favor. So, and that then ends up producing jobs as well, because it means that some firms find it in their interest to use open source software, which has certain advantages. And if you're doing open source software, it's nice to have an employee who's part of that in team, as it were. And in fact, I've even seen this argument made by someone to explain how you get basic scientific research produced on the market. And his argument is that it is valuable to firms doing applied scientific work to know what's happening in the basic work, because that's going to be the basis for their later work. And that the people who know what's happening in the basic science are the ones who are doing it, because they talk to each other. And it therefore pays a firm to have an employee, part of whose work appears to be directly useless doing basic research, because he then is their source for knowing what's going on in that world. I'm not sure if it's right, but that was an interesting argument. So I think there are mechanisms of that sort, and I'm not quite sure how that's going to play out in the defense context. Yes.
Some of the reasons that we currently go to war for, like foreign aid and national, like,
I would have said that things of that sort ought to be dealt with by private voluntary activity. The standard model, although it was a model supported by the left, not by us, would be the Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War, which was a bunch of left-wing volunteers from America who went to fight on what they thought was the good side in that war. As it turned out, there wasn't a good side in that war, but we all make mistakes once in a while. I think in general, this is sort of getting into the general foreign policy issue, and I think the U.S. intervention has done a very poor job of preventing that. That one of the things that strikes me, if you look at U.S. policy in Africa, is that the Republic of South Africa, in the process of maintaining a minority rule government, killed some hundreds of people. The government of Nigeria, in the course of maintaining its rule, killed about 1 million people. That was the Biafran War, the Nigerian Civil War. Several other black African nations killed in the hundreds of thousands of their own inhabitants in the process of maintaining the rule where we're ruling them. South Africa was the one we protested against. Why? Because South Africa's problems fit into a particular image in terms of our history, white suppressing blacks, and the fact that you had much worse things happening with blacks suppressing blacks didn't have that effect. So that in general, I think we were very poor, that the mechanisms that determine what we get angry about are not very carefully calculated. But I would say that where bad things are happening, I think it would be appropriate for citizens who think they're bad to raise money and volunteer and do stuff. Yes. Absolute necessity, no. I don't think I can predict the future very well. One of my books is called Future Imperfect, and that was an attempt to look at technological revolutions over about the next 30 years and what their implications were. And one of my conclusions writing that book is I really didn't want to go much farther than 30 years because the future is much more uncertain than people think. I think almost everybody is much too conservative. And you can see that in lots of contexts. The real assumption is 100 years from now will be just about like now with a few tweaks. And that's very, very unlikely. So I don't know what it's going to be. And it might be that you would have technologies in which war is impossible. There might be technologies in which, you know, a kid in his basement can wipe out the human race. Those are not impossible. All I was trying to do was to imagine something not too far from the world as we now know it. And seeing how you could manage in that kind of world without a state.
So, like, in a world from now, when you have nuclear bombs, I mean...
You still need a standing army.
Okay. But, I mean, you know, if you want to mess with someone, I'd say this is closer to a peace that we're in Iraq, and, you know, these people might have access, or fashion societies have access to bombs, if another society wants to be... Hey, we got news.
Maybe, but they may have them too, right? You may be very reluctant to use them. Maybe. Yes.
Yes. When you look into the different small utopia scenarios,
I don't do utopia scenarios, but anyway. So, what's your question?
My question is for yourself personally in your career as a speaker, where you see a significant change in your life and in your future relative to your own career.
The only really big change I can see in my future is if somebody manages to cure the lethal disease that's killing all of us, which is called old age. And I think there are probably people in this room who will not get old. That's my guess, I think, looking at it. But I'm probably not one of them, though I hope I am. I think it probably won't happen that fast. So that's the only place where I can see. Other than that, if you read Future Imperfect, I can imagine a variety of ways in which the world could change radically within my lifespan. But I don't know which one is going to happen. I should say, one of the points that I made in Future Imperfect, published some years ago, was that we now had the technology which was practical to tap every phone in America.
and I was right. Yes.
Is it fair to say that you reject the idea of psychological egoism, that all of us essentially are looking out for our own best interests?
Now, I'm not even sure I know what that means. That is, I think individuals have objectives and pursue them. I think that's really the economic assumption. But the objectives clearly include other people as well as ourselves. That I'm willing to make some sacrifices in order that other people I care about will be better off. And I'd be willing to make some sacrifices in order that people I've never met be better off, just not very large sacrifices. All right. So I think if you look at actual human behavior, it's clear that people have a heavy bias in their own favor, a somewhat lighter bias in the favor of their, you know, wives, children, close friends, and so forth. And then I think most people have a generally benevolent feeling that on the whole it would be nice if all those strangers I've never met, you know, were happy and healthy and well-fit. So does that answer your question? I'm not sure I understand you.
Actually, I'm just trying to reconcile what you were discussing earlier with, you know, real extreme scarcity, not just like relative scarcity, but if, you know, some horrible dust bowl happened again and if you are in an anarcho-capitalist society, let's just go ahead and say that it becomes a little bit more obscure.
It looks pretty bad under those circumstances for the government, too. That it is not clear. I'm not sure if you appreciate just how rich we are. The estimate, I was reading a book by McCloskey, and the figure she gives is that the average real income of the entire world at present is roughly 10 times what it was through most of history. And the average real income of the developed world is about 20 or 30 times what it was through most of history. So in a sense, most of history was lived under worse circumstances than you're imagining. If you think about it, it seems to me if I told you we're going to have a catastrophe that cuts the income of Americans tenfold, that sounds like your Dust Bowl. That doesn't get us back to where most of the world was in 1600. Yeah.
So, yeah, some libertarians assert that the, like, decentralized feudal institutions of medieval Europe are in some way superior to the democratic nation-state that we exist in today. I know you've done work on the institutions of Iceland and Ireland.
Iceland was certainly not feudal. Ireland, a little bit less clear and depends when. But feudalism is an interesting system. I'm actually more interested in feud than in feudalism, and they turn out to be unrelated words, even though they sound similar. But feudalism, I don't think feudalism is clearly worse than a centralized government. It's a different way of organizing your political structure, and it, you know, in certain circumstances might work out better or worse. One thing a lot of people get wrong about history is that they imagine that in the Middle Ages people believed in the divine right of kings and that kings were all powerful. And that's really about a 17th century invention. The divine right of kings, I think the term was coined by King James, Elizabeth's successor, in the early 17th century. So that the typical feudal king was really a coalition leader, depending on getting support from the nobles in order to have an army. But was it better or worse than ours? There are so many differences, and, you know, across society, it's very hard to answer that kind of question.